You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with local gardening expert Charlie Nardozzi. I spoke with Charlie last Wednesday in front of an audience at the South Burlington Community Library as part of their Brown Bag Lunch series. Charlie Nardozzi is a garden coach and consultant, teaching and inspiring home gardeners to grow the best vegetables, fruits, flowers, trees, and shrubs in their yards. He writes the Edible Landscaping online newsletter, bringing timely information to vegetable, fruit, and herb gardeners every month. He also co-hosts In the Garden on local CBS affiliate WCAX, a weekly call-in radio show on WJOY, and the Vermont Garden Journal on Vermont Public Radio. Charlie has written for national magazines such as Organic Gardening and contributed to many of the Gardening for Dummies titles, authoring Vegetable Gardening for Dummies in 2009. He authored The Ultimate Gardener, which highlights heartwarming stories about the trials and tribulations of gardening, and contributed to other book projects such as Vegetables from an Italian Garden in 2011. Charlie Nardozzi's skills as a garden communicator extend beyond the printed page. He's the former host of PBS's Garden Smart, reaching more than 60 million households. He's also been a gardening expert on many national syndicated television and radio shows, such as HGTV's Today at Home, Discovery Channel's Home Matters, Sirius Radio's Martha Stewart Living, and Natural Eating with Alyssa. Charlie also works with companies and organizations to provide horticultural guidance on special adult and kids projects. He's worked with the Hilton Garden Inn on their Grow a School Garden project, Gardener's Supply Company and Stonyfield Yogurt on their Eat a Rainbow project, and farm to school programs with Shelburne Farms and Northeast Organic Farmers Association. He was the senior horticulturist and spokesperson for the National Gardening Association. He wrote and edited articles for their magazine and online newsletters, conducted media interviews about gardening, and provided horticultural consultation to NGA programs. When I spoke to Charlie at the library, we discussed his latest book, Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening, which was released earlier this month. Our library event began with an introduction by South Burlington librarian Naomi Miller, who organized the event. The recorded interview begins with my first questions for Charlie. Welcome. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
So this is Charlie Nardozzi. Charlie has a new book coming out called Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. So I'll first ask, when does that come out and where will it be available?
It is out. As of April. It's available online. Amazon has it. I'm not sure local bookstores have it yet, but
okay.
I think they
probably will have.
Yeah, Barnes & Noble and some of the independent bookstores will have it too.
Okay.
Yeah, and you can buy it on my website, charlienardozzi.com. So.
Okay.
Lots of ways to get it.
Lots of ways. So in the new book, you write about having helped your family garden as
mm-hmm.
a child.
Yeah.
And you also write about having your own garden in college, but you sort of refer to yourself at that point as a novice gardener. You had, you made a couple mistakes, I noticed, in college. So what is your gardening background? How did you come to be an expert gardener?
Well, we'll go way back. So I grew up in Connecticut, and I grew up in the shadow of my Italian grandparents' farm. And every time one of their kids got married, they gave a piece of land to their children to build their house. And so I grew up with the farmhouse at the bottom of the hill. And then as you go up the hill, there was my uncle's house, my aunt's house, my uncle's house, our house, and my aunt's house.
Wow.
All in a row. And there's just a bunch of them are still there.
Okay.
God bless them. They're in their 80s, but they're still there.
Is this your father's side?
This is my mother's side.
Your mother's side.
All my mother's
okay.
side. So the backyards of all these houses was the farm, mm-hmm. all the farm fields and everything. So I grew up with this, now that I look at it, very idyllic setting where I had a constant companions to play with and had all these fields and forests and orchards and gardens to go roaming around in.
Mm.
So I have a lot of fond memories of helping pick cherries with my uncle. He would put us in the bucket of this tractor and raise us up and we would pick the cherries out of the tree. Or going around with my Italian grandfather, Rocco. And Rocco had a very special way of pruning his tomatoes. If you know Italian gardeners or farmers, they strip everything down and they put a stake in. You got your one stem with a few tomatoes hanging out and the stake, and that's about it.
Oh, wow.
So I would help him do that and help him pick potatoes in the late summer. So it kind of was got into my system, you might say, back then.
Yeah.
So then I went to school at UVM as an 18-year-old and was loved the outdoors and really didn't think about gardening or farming. So what I ended up doing was majoring in environmental studies at first. And then after a couple of years, back then environmental studies was a little woo-woo. You know, it was like
a little out there.
I was kind of a little nervous about getting a job after I was done with college. So I decided to do a little something more practical. So I transferred into horticulture and got a degree in horticulture. And then started working in the horticultural field and then started actually actively gardening myself. Like a lot of people, when you're young, you kind of get exposed to it with your parents or your grandparents. Right. But then in your teen years or in your college, you just don't have the resources to really be gardening much.
Right.
So I really learned a lot of the practical skills once I got out of college and then started working in the field and doing my own garden, doing gardens for other people and working in a horticultural industry.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Now, did you anticipate you were going to be a farmer at that point when you were studying, or did you think that you would be doing something along the lines of what you actually do?
I was thinking it would be more education, because that was where my interest was,
okay.
And I really wasn't interested in being a farmer, seeing how hard my grandfather worked
yeah.
as a farmer.
Yeah.
I really wasn't interested in just doing that end of it. So I was going to do some kind of educational aspect of it, and I ended up working for National Gardening Magazine when I got out of college.
Okay.
So I ended up becoming a writer, which was something I never thought I would do, but I ended up doing.
Great.
Yeah.
Okay. What do you think is the greatest challenge for a northeastern gardener? And we can maybe even say as specific as Vermont, which is maybe a little different zone than some other northeastern states. So.
Well, it's a challenge and it's also kind of a benefit because every year is different.
Okay.
Every year you don't know what's going to happen. And the last two are great examples of that. 2 years ago, the winter, we had nothing but snow, tons of snow. Huge piles of snow. I knew because we were building our house during that snow, that snowy winter. But this winter, we've had hardly any snow and warm temperatures. So every year it shifts, and every year it's different, and especially in the Northeast, where we tend to be the place in the country where all the weather congregates at the end of its trip across country, it seems. So you get things coming up the coast, things coming from the west, cold fronts coming from the north, it all kind of converges on the northeast.
Mm-hmm.
So we get all kinds of wild, wacky weather, and you never know what's going to happen. So as a gardener, you have to kind of be ready every year for anything.
Yeah.
A dry spring, a wet spring, a hot spring, a cold spring, you know, pests, no pests, well, I've yet to have the no-pest summer.
Right. So any prognostications about this summer?
Well, it's starting out very dry, which is a bit of a concern, especially this early in the year. But it's hard to know if it's just going to rain all June, July, and August, or it's going to stay hot and dry. So
right.
I'm not going to venture out on a limb on that one.
Okay. All right. Now, you've just moved to a new property. I read that online, and I also just heard you say that you were building a house. So how hard has it been trying to establish your new gardens?
We're working on it.
Were the gardens there before?
There was nothing there before.
Oh, okay.
It's 5 acres of open meadow, pretty much, with some hedgerows around it. And last year we moved in, last summer, last June we moved in. I actually followed my own advice, which is unusual. I didn't grow a garden at all. We didn't have any kind of gardens going on. What we did is we marked out the areas where the vegetable garden would be, the orchard, the berry bushes, the grapes, all that stuff, tilled it under, got some local farmer to bring in a bunch of manure, and then we cover cropped it. We cover cropped it last summer and last fall and through the winter, and then just recently we've tilled it all under because it's been so dry. And we got a bunch more compost in, and we have just started to plant some things.
Okay.
So we're just starting to get things up and running, and we have lots of things coming in, fruit trees, berry bushes. So if you guys have nothing to do the next few weeks, you want to come plant.
Okay, great. So you've had to decide where everything would go, and in the new book, Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening, you have a chapter where you talk about how to decide where to put your garden.
Mm-hmm.
I liked the quote. He said, out of sight is out of mind, so be sure that you can see your garden. I thought that was great.
Yes.
Some other tips about where you place your, let's say, vegetable garden or fruit garden?
Yeah. For the vegetable garden, a lot of people, the tradition is to kind of stick it out in the backyard somewhere or out behind the shed or behind the garage or something. That's like the worst place to put it. You really should put it up front and center. In my old house in Shelburne, I had it right in the front lawn. So I'd be out there working the vegetables and people be walking by. It's like, oh, Charlie, what are you growing over there? Which was kind of nice, and sometimes I was just like a little quiet and just to be in the garden by myself.
Right.
But it was a great way to have it just front and center, because every day I walk out, I'd see it right there. If I saw something that needed to be done, I would stop and do it.
Right.
Whereas if it's out of sight, you're not going to really spend the time doing doing that. Yeah. Most vegetables need full sun. That was another reason why I had that vegetable garden at that house right in the front yard, because that's where it got the most sun. The backyard was more shady. It needs well-drained soil, and another reason, because the backyard also had seasonal flooding in it. So in April and May, especially if it rained a lot, it would actually be some almost standing water back there, which is not going to work for vegetables. So you need well-drained soil, full sun, a location that's close to where you're going. And if you're just starting out, I always tell people to start small and start with raised beds. Because raised beds are great. You raise them up 8 to 10 inches, about 3 feet wide. And you can bring in some compost, some topsoil. A mix is usually best, not just straight compost, because that's a little too rich, a soil medium. And if you have clay soil or sandy soil, you don't even have to deal with what's there naturally. You can just create your own bed with your own soil. And then having that edging, you create a natural definition from where the lawn is, where other gardens are, and where these beds are. And you don't have to step on them. It doesn't compact the soil. It warms up faster, drains out sooner in the spring. So it's really a great way to go is to use raised bed gardening.
Okay. So I have a couple questions about raised bed gardening.
Sure.
First of all, I have clay soil. And so I've spent years tilling stuff into it to try to get it a little more crumbly and easier to work with. But
yes.
You're sort of a no-tilling gardener, I noticed in your book. You're not big on tilling. So I was going to ask you about that. But I also wanted to ask you, when you raise the beds, so you're bringing in new soil to raise beds.
Yes.
And then do you build those up every year, or do you bring in new soil every year? How do you do that?
Well, you'd have to add some more soil every year, because just through the natural growing process, you're going to have some decline of that soil. So, yeah, bringing in a layer of compost every year or a compost topsoil mix just to kind of top it off each year is
right.
a good idea. And you can make your own compost, too, by doing it that way. Now, in our new situation with our vegetable garden, it's on clay soil, just like yours.
Yeah.
So we've been adding organic matter, just like you. And the garden is too big to really do all these raised beds and bring in all this new soil. So we are going to work with what we have. But what we're intending and doing is not necessarily raising up the beds and tilling it under every year, but just adding compost on the top and what I call the Martha Stewart method of fluffing the top. So just getting an iron fork and just kind of loosening up the soil in the spring, kind of breaking up the clods a little bit, putting down a layer of compost, and then planting in that.
Okay.
Now, it may look a little lumpy. It may not look like the beautiful, nice, manicured bed that you might be used to, but it's just as effective as far as growing things.
So let's talk a little bit about tilling, the pros and cons of tilling.
So the pros of tilling is very satisfying. You get your tiller, you go out there, everything gets kind of turned under, it looks nice afterwards.
Right.
The cats come over, they can use it as a litter box, it's really great. So tilling is a quick way just to turn the soil under, get rid of weeds, get everything kind of ready. The downside of tilling is that it introduces oxygen into the soil. So by introducing oxygen, it will burn up a lot of that organic matter that's in the soil faster. And the organic matter is what you want, especially if you have a clay soil, that's going to make it looser, more friable, more easy to work.
Mm-hmm.
If you keep tilling it, you're just kind of burning up the organic matter, so you have to add more and more each year. You kind of get in this cycle of adding a lot of organic matter each year. Also, when you're tilling it, you're going down probably about a foot, and you're bringing up the soil from below, and you're bringing up weed seeds. So as those weed seeds get dropped on the surface of that soil, you get a lot of weed growth.
Okay.
So if you're tilling it annually, you'll get a big flush of weeds almost the same time as a lot of your seeds are coming up.
Okay.
By no-tilling, what you're doing is you're building up organic matter each year. You're just kind of building on what you have. You're not turning it under, so you're not getting as much weed growth, and you're not introducing the oxygen, so you're not going to have as much of that organic matter kind of burning up. So it's an easier method of keeping things growing, keeping things fertile without having to work so hard to make it look perfect.
Great. Mm-hmm. Thanks. Okay, well, you just mentioned that you put in a cover crop last fall. Is that when you did that?
Late summer, yeah.
Late summer, okay. So let's talk a little bit about cover crops. What are the best crops to use to enrich the soil, and how did you choose?
Choose the one you chose. Yeah. Well, one of the things I recommend, if you have enough room in your garden, is to leave one bed or a couple beds fallow every year. Give the soil a little chance to kind of rejuvenate itself.
Mm-hmm.
It's worked, obviously, you have to have a big enough garden to be able to do that, because it breaks your heart not to plant every square inch of the garden.
Right.
But if you can do that, you can grow a cover crop all summer long, and the cover crop of choice for that would be buckwheat. Because buckwheat goes from seed to flowering in about 40 days, really quick, big leaves, it's very quick growing, it's got a lot of organic matter to it. And so you can grow it starting, say, in May and get maybe two or three crops of it before you even get to September. Mm-hmm. And you just till, what you do is you let it grow up to the flower stage right before it starts flowering, or a little bit afterwards, and let the bees enjoy the flowers. And then cut it down, till it under, or turn it under. Mm-hmm. In this case, it wouldn't work so much with the no-tilling, so you have to kind of weigh the benefits of each.
Yeah.
And let it decompose a little bit and then seed it again and just kind of keep doing that. The cover crops for winter would be things that would make it through the winter. So winter rye, winter wheat works really well. I did a mix of winter rye and hairy vetch, which is a legume, and it fixes nitrogen in the soil. It's a nice combination to go with the cereal grains that have a lot of organic matter but don't really fix any nitrogen or add nutrients in and of themselves. So you put that in August, September. You let that grow up. It'll last through the winter. It'll stay green through the winter. Mm-hmm. I actually made some green shakes out of winter rye grass. And if you think ever had winter wheat juice, you know,
right? Yep.
Or just wheat juice, or wheatgrass juice, it's the same thing.
Okay.
It's grass and juice, right? Why pay $5 for a glass when you go out there and harvest it yourself? So I did that and threw it in my shakes in the morning, and it was great. And the deer loved it, too.
Oh,
I made a lot of friends with the deer.
We don't want to make friends with the deer.
Yeah, they're really very cozy. Because it was the only green thing all winter. So we would see them out there every evening munching away at it and dropping their manure. So they left a little fertilizer and they got some green cover crop. Of course, we're going to have to fence everything this spring.
Right.
But, so and then in the spring, as soon as it dries out enough, and this year it's been so dry we were able to do it a week or two ago, you come in and you just turn it all under. You turn all that material under.
Okay.
So if you're doing the no-till method, this whole process, you do have to turn it under. You have to turn the material down again. So you're going to have to kind of sacrifice a little bit of tilling or a little bit of turning under to get the benefit of the organic matter.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm thinking of we're doing in this situation is we're going to do cover crops the first few years at least to really kind of build up that soil and then kind of transition more into a permanent no-till situation.
Now, you mentioned that the cover crop that you used added a little nitrogen to the soil, and that reminds me that you, in the book, you talk about nitrogen, potassium, and phosphorus being the three main things that you look for in soil and having those at a balance. So I'm just wondering, where do you get soil tested around here? Where should we look to get our soil tested?
Well, you can do it yourself with these kits, and they're fine, but they're not going to give you a very accurate reading, like a detailed reading.
Okay.
The easiest thing to do is to send it up to the University of Vermont. They have a soil test lab up there. I think for $20 or $30, they'll give you a soil test based on what you're growing. So if you're growing a vegetable garden, you want to tell them that. If you're growing blueberries, you tell them that, because each crop is going to have different needs. And they'll give you an indication of the pH of the soil, the organic matter content, which for vegetables should be between 5 and 10%, ideally. And then the phosphorus, potassium, calcium, magnesium, a lot of different major elements, they'll give you the levels and where they stand as far as is it ideal, are you deficient in it. And then at the bottom, they give you recommendations. And especially if you're an organic gardener, they'll give you organic recommendations, too, of what you can do to get your soil back into a kind of a healthy homeostasis state.
All right. You talk in the book a little bit about edible landscaping.
Mm-hmm.
Can we talk about that?
Sure. I love talking about that.
Okay.
So edible landscaping is the idea of replacing or planting edible trees and shrubs, and actually vegetables and beautiful flowers, instead of ones that are just solely ornamental.
Mm-hmm.
So instead of just planting a burning bush, for example, in the front of your yard as a foundation plant, grow blueberries. Because they have similar kind of characteristics to them. The burning bush gets a beautiful red foliage in the fall, so does the blueberry. But the blueberry also has beautiful white little flowers, bell-shaped flowers in the spring, and then, of course, the berries that you can eat. So the idea with edible landscaping is to take a look at your yard with an edible lens. Kind of look at the trees that you want to plant, the shrubs you want to plant, even the flower beds you're planting or the vegetable garden, and incorporate beautiful selections of each one of those that are edible at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a number of different things that I like to talk about around this. There's a dwarf cherry tree that I recommend called Dwarf North Star.
Mm-hmm.
It only gets 6 to 8 feet tall, and it is a sour cherry, but it has a really nice flavor to it, meaning that if you left it on the tree long enough, you can really just eat it out of hand. It's not like it's so sour you don't want to eat it fresh.
Yeah.
And it only needs one tree to pollinate. So you don't have to get a couple different trees. It's a beautiful tree in the landscape, so why grow a flowering plum or a flowering crab apple when you can grow a flowering cherry like that and get the fruit from it?
Okay. Yeah. All right, great. Now, a few years ago, we have a plum tree on our property, and a few years ago, we had just so many plums. It was unbelievable. Yeah. And then the next year, like two. So what's going on there?
Well, plum trees, like pear trees and apples sometimes, depending on the variety, they can do a thing called alternate bearing.
Okay.
And alternate bearing is when they produce a ton of fruit one year, and then the next year they don't produce hardly anything. And basically what happens is that they kind of burn themselves out that first year. They produce a lot of fruiting wood, and they produce a lot of fruit. And then the second year, they've really kind of run out of energy to do that.
Okay.
And so they have to take a little rest. So the way to get around alternate bearing is to select varieties that don't do that, or to make sure you annually prune your fruit trees. And even with plums or pears, where you don't have to prune them a lot, just by taking off some of the fruiting wood or by thinning them once they get the size of about a quarter or so, when you see a lot of fruit that are forming and they've already done their June drop and there's still a lot of fruit up on the tree, thinning them out so that the plums, for example, might be 3 or 4 inches apart, that's going to reduce the crop load, and so you'll get less likelihood of that turning into an alternate bearing the next year.
All right, great. Yeah. All right, good to know. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the organization of the book, which I thought was just wonderful.
At the beginning of the book, you talk more generally, and then as you go on at the end, especially Chapter 8, there's a lot of reference to, we'll get to that in Chapter 8. As I'm reading the book, I keep going like, Chapter 8 is going to have to be gigantic, because everything was like, Chapter 8 is coming. But Chapter 8 was wonderful. It was the listing of all sorts of different fruits and vegetables and lots of details about what to expect from them, where to plant them, when to plant them.
Yeah.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about planning the layout of the book. From the writing perspective, did you plan it all yourself? Did you have an editor's input? How did you?
Well, I came up with a table of contents, and then we kind of went back and forth a little bit. But it was mostly my idea behind it. So I wanted to really lead it off, as we did in the book, with ideas about what's unique about Northeast gardening, what's unique about this region of the country, and the, like you're saying, the challenges and some of the benefits of growing here, and kind of identifying different climactic zones and soil zones too. You know, it's a very diverse area when you really think about it, from the pine barrens of New Jersey to the rocky crags of Maine to the fertile valleys of the Champlain Valley in Vermont. You know, so you get
the Nardozzi Hill in Connecticut.
The Nardozzi Hill in Connecticut, right? So there's lots of hills and valleys and different kinds of soils. So it's a pretty unique area that can grow a variety of different crops.
Right.
So I wanted to start off with that, and then have the basics of soils and fertilizers and all kind of planning, kind of getting it all arranged. But really have the meat of the book being that chapter, which is like an encyclopedia of all the individual fruits and vegetables and how you can grow them, varieties that have worked well in this region, and different experiences you can expect for them.
Okay, great. And then at the end there's resource chapter that's very helpful, very useful.
Right, because it's not really an all-inclusive book in the sense that you'll find everything you need there. So it's really good to go to the resource section and find out some details about things that might not be mentioned or more details about them.
Yeah, it is a pretty comprehensive book, though. I thought it had a lot. Okay, so we're approaching the season for planting, and you mentioned that you kind of started. Do you is the things that you were watering today, are they in cold frames or are
no? They're on raised beds. We started to form some of our raised beds.
Okay,
in the
so we're already
garden.
There.
Yeah. Yes, we are already.
So I really
there.
Am late.
Not really. I'm just more avid.
Okay.
No, but if because it's been so warm and it's been so dry, you know, we had that really warm spell in March that really kicked things into gear. And you got forsythia blooming, and magnolias blooming, and daffodils blooming, and everyone's like, it's going to all die, it's all going to die. Well, it didn't die.
Yay.
It's still blooming. But what it did is it dried out the soil and warmed up the soil so that you can grow a lot of the spring greens, and that's what we sowed. Arugula, mosh, mesclun mixes that have mustards and mizuna and spinach and things like that, and those all can be sown now, and they'll germinate actually pretty quickly under these conditions. But if you are sowing those this early in the season, there's still a chance that it can get pretty cold at night. So we put a floating row cover over that bed that we just sowed.
Okay.
And the floating row cover is a cheesecloth-like material. It's white. It lets in air, light, and water. But it's also like a blanket. It's heavy enough that it'll actually warm the soil and keep the soil warm. So down into the mid-20s or so, your plants could be protected underneath it.
So if you walk into a gardening store and say, I want a floating row blanket, they'll know what that is? Or
a floating row cover? They should.
Cover.
If they don't,
Then they should.
Yeah, right, they should.
So that's what you do.
And that's a nice material to use. You can actually get different weights of it. So the one we're using right now is for frost control and to keep the soil and the plants a little bit warmer once they germinate. In the summer, you can use a similar one that's a lightweight floating row cover. That's much lighter weight, lets a lot more air in it, so it doesn't heat up the soil as much, but it's mostly used as an insect control. Okay. So it keeps the bugs off of your plants as well.
All right.
So that's the other benefit of having a floating row cover. You know, if you're starting some greens this time of year, you might get flea beetles, which are a little black beetle. They love to put little shotgun-like holes in the leaves of spinach and Swiss chard and things like that. But if you put a floating row cover over them, a lot of times you can reduce the amount of flea beetle damage.
Okay. Now, you do have a wonderful chapter on pest control.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, not just control, but inviting helpful pests, which I thought was interesting.
Yeah.
I didn't know that much about helpful pests.
Uh-huh.
So maybe a few tips about pest control?
Diversity is always great. You know, plant a wide variety of things, wide variety of vegetables, flowers, herbs. Let some wild plants grow. You know, have trees and shrubs around. You really want to create kind of an ecosystem that beneficial insects will really be able to thrive in, because they're the ones who are going to kind of keep that balance in your garden, taking care of those other pests that are the harmful ones.
Okay.
Having water nearby, and it could be as simple as a bird bath or just a little, if you have a pond, that's great, but just a water source close by is really nice. Having grass paths between beds or around near your garden where beneficials can hide, and then growing a lot of the flowers that they like and herbs that they like. A lot of the umbelliferous flowers, like a Queen Anne's lace or cilantro when it goes to seed or to flower, are really nice. They're very attractive to a lot of beneficial insects. So having those scattered about, too, is a good way to attract them to the garden, so you don't have to do as much work to take care of the harmful ones.
Okay, and then having the bird bath nearby, doesn't it attract the unattractive pests? Or
the unattractive pests, like the birds?
Bad pests, do they like having the water there too? Or?
No, not as much.
Not as much.
Yeah. Most of the insects that are in your garden are not harmful at all.
Okay.
You know, and there's a bunch of beneficial ones, and it's only a small minority that you really have to watch out for in any kind of serious way in a vegetable garden.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Fruits are a little bit different.
Yeah.
Fruits have a lot of other pests that, again, it's probably a small number of them, but they can be very harmful.
Okay. All right. So you talked about diversity within mm-hmm. the planting. So let's talk a little bit about intercropping. Is that the same
yeah.
thing? And well, how to know what to intercrop with what?
With what? Yeah. Intercropping is a technique for kind of a space-saving technique for
okay.
vegetable gardening. And actually you can use it for other kind of gardening too, but mostly for vegetables. And the idea is that you have a bed and you're planting something that's going to get large later in the summer, like a tomato or a broccoli plant.
Uh-huh.
But when you plant it, it's just a little seedling. But you have to plant it 2 feet, 3 feet apart between plants, because you know they're going to get large someday.
Right.
So you have all this room in between those plants that's just barren, that's just sitting there. Weeds are waiting to grow in that. So intercropping is the idea of planting a short season or a quick growing plant in between those plants to use up that space. So radishes, any of the lettuces, spinach, mesclun mix, anything that's going to grow up quickly within 30, 40 days or so and you can harvest it, that's going to be really effective.
Okay, and it won't get too big.
Right, it won't get too big. It'll grow up, you harvest it, and by the time you're harvesting it, then the broccolis and the tomatoes are starting to fill in so they can actually take up that space where these intercrop plants were growing.
Okay, all right, great. How about some other tips about weeding?
Weeding early and often.
Oh, I know what I wanted to ask. What is the tool? You referred to the tool that you used to like that you like to use
yes,
for weeding.
The three-prong cultivator.
Okay.
And it's a long-handled tool, and it literally has metal prongs that come off like that. And it's a great tool for lots of different things. So if you're making like little furrows to plant some seeds, putting your bean seeds in or something, you can use this tool for that.
Making
the furrow itself. If you're weeding, it's a great way to weed out different weeds. If you're hilling up potatoes, you can use it for that. I use it for a lot of different things. So that's a nice tool to use. If you're weeding a bed and the weeds are just coming up, you can use a flat-bladed, a thin flat-bladed hoe.
Mm-hmm.
It's really nice because you just want to just cut the weeds right below the soil line. You don't want to really dig down deep with your hoe because
uh-huh.
that's going to bring more weed seeds up. So if you just scuffle along the top of it, there's actually a hoe called a scuffle hoe, and you just kind of scuffle along the top of it when they're really small. If you do that regularly, like a couple times a week, once everything is planted and you notice the weeds are coming up, and you do that, I would say maybe for a month or so, you'll notice for the rest of the summer you'll have very few weed problems.
Now, are you mostly standing up and doing this with these tools? You're not like down and...
You're not down
on
sweating on your knees, grinding, the mosquitoes
biting. I've been doing this wrong.
No, you're standing up, you're relaxed. One hand you got your drink, the other hand you got your hoe. Maybe right. Drinks for later.
Okay, so actually I think now is probably a really good time to gather any questions that the audience has. And if there aren't very many, I've got some more later, but let's make sure we get to those. Okay, so the first question that was given to me from the audience came early. She's very interested to know how to trim a magnolia tree, which is currently at about 7 or 8 feet in height.
Oh, the question is, why would you want to trim a magnolia tree?
Because it's in front of the kitchen window.
Oh, you planted the wrong plant in the wrong place.
It said it would only grow about 6 feet, and so I put it there, and it just blocks the view of the mountain, the valley.
Oh, that's a shame.
When it leaves out. The flowers are fine. It's when the leaves
Come out. Yeah. Well,
I shouldn't have put it there.
Yeah, there's a great example of the right plant in the right place. And
they said I have 6 feet.
Yeah, well, don't always believe what they say.
None of them are the height they say they're going to be.
Yeah. Is this a star magnolia bush?
It's supposed the white to be one? Like a bush type thing, but it's more a tree, I think.
So when you the time to prune magnolias would be after they're done flowering, so pretty soon, once they're done with their flowering, then you can prune them. And to try to keep it short and bushy, I would prune it back to where there's some side branches and prune it right above that. And prune it down as far as you want. You know, the magnolia will branch out at different points in time along the trunk or along those branches. I assume it's a multiple stemmed shrub versus a tree.
Well, I've actually only got two sizable ones coming out of the ground. But it might be because I trimmed the others as they were coming.
Well, that could be.
I was trying to make a tree, and I did.
Yeah. If you have those two main trunks that are coming out, you prune it down to a height. So if you want to keep it at 6 feet, I would prune it down to maybe 4.5-5 feet lower to anticipate some growth, because it's going to want to grow. That's kind of what magnolias do in most parts.
I tend to overdo. I had a neighbor who saw me cut a lilac and said, I'll never let you near me for a haircut.
Well, most people tend to underprune when they prune. You know, they see a lilac that's too large, and they'll prune it back to, they want it to be at 6 feet, so they'll prune it back to 6 feet. But then, of course, it's going to grow in response to the pruning, and then next year you're back where you started from. You're still dealing with a 7-8 foot tall plant. So prune it back lower to where than you want it. Then that way you can prune it. You're probably going to have to prune it every year. But if you do it right after it's done flowering, it'll have enough time to set flower buds for the next year, and you won't lose the flowers.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay, so another question is, what are some tips for getting rid of moles in vegetable gardens?
Moles in vegetable gardens. Well, first of all, moles are just kind of tunneling around looking for little critters to eat. They eat little protozoas and arthropods and earthworms and things like that. They don't really harm the roots of your plants. But what they do is create tunnels that mice and voles can then go in, and they're the ones who will eat your carrots. You never have a situation where you grow carrots in a raised bed, and you pull them up, and there's nothing at the bottom. It's like those cartoons. You know? Where did they go? I've had that happen, actually. And that's the little mice and voles during the summer just looking for something to eat. So it is a good idea to get rid of the moles out of your vegetable garden, even though they're not really the ones causing the damage. And the best thing to use for that is castor oil. They hate the smell of castor oil. Mm. And so you get castor oil that has been not deodorized. That is odorant. What would the word be?
It smells bad.
That has a smell, yes. So don't get the one in the grocery store. Go to a garden center and get the castor oil. There's a lot of different brands of it. It comes in a liquid, and now I think it's a pellet form, too. You sprinkle that around the area where the moles are active, not where the old tunnels are, but where they seem to be going out in that area, and that will get them very agitated. So for a couple days, they'll be scurrying all over the place, and then they'll take off, go to your neighbor's yard, and you won't see them again.
I used that. My neighbor.
Yeah. Well, then you can give it to your neighbor for a Christmas gift.
But you are putting it on the radio.
Yes.
Okay. This person says, hi, Charlie. So I assume it's someone who knows you. It's about mulch. Do you believe in the red plastic for tomatoes? Is the first of three questions.
Do I believe in it? That's a question. Well, theoretically, according to research, it's supposed to increase tomato yields by 20%. because the wavelength that's reflected back up into the plant is one that stimulates more growth and more tomato production.
Let's talk about what is red plastic.
Red plastic is, well, people are mostly familiar with black plastic, and they can use it as a mulch to heat. You put it over the bed in the spring.
Okay.
It preheats the soil, makes it nice and warm, and then you poke holes in it and you plant warm season crops like tomatoes, peppers, eggplants, squashes, melons, things like that, plants that need a lot of extra heat. So researchers have been experimenting with different colored plastics for different uses. So there's dark green plastic out there now that supposedly is better for things like melons, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's red plastic mulch that is supposedly good for tomatoes and strawberries. So I've been using it pretty religiously for a bunch of years. And have I noticed a big difference? Not really. Now, to be honest, not really. Now, maybe if I sat down and actually weighed the tomatoes of this plant versus that plant, and maybe it was 20% more, but it's not like there's like big tomato plant, little tomato plant. I think the key is just to have fertile soil and then use some kind of plastic mulch. I still really believe in the plastic mulch with tomatoes because it does a couple different things. It warms the soil up, it keeps the soil moist, which tomatoes like, and it prevents or slows down the onset of early blight and septoria leaf spot. A lot of those soil-borne fungal diseases that'll get on tomatoes and start causing the leaves to get yellow and spotted and drop.
Mm.
So having that mulch down there kind of slows it down a little bit.
Okay.
But and I'm a firm believer that I only will use red plastic. I'm not so sure.
Okay. And then the second question is, do the pathway mulches need to be permeable to water? And can you use, for example, rubber mats?
I like using something that's permeable to water, even if it's something like cardboard, just because, especially if you're using plastic mulch on the beds themselves, the plastic obviously is not permeable to water, so the plants are really looking for water at that point. And a lot of times they will go into, they'll stretch themselves into the pathways to get that moisture. So I usually recommend using things like straw mulch, hay mulch, dried up leaves, cardboard, shredded newspaper, anything that's organic matter that is permeable to water as a mulch in the pathways. If you want to use wood chips and bark chips, that's fine too. And that way it provides a place for those roots to go to get some moisture, and it still keeps the weeds from going. And when you're doing my method of no-tilling, what I end up doing sometimes is that I use those pathways almost like sheet composting areas. So I'm building up compost there because I'm putting all this organic matter. So by the end of the summer, there's actually some nice soil that's starting to develop underneath there
mm-hmm.
that I can kind of skim off, throw it on top of the bed, and then do the whole process again the next year.
Okay. Do you change where you grow everything each year?
Yes, you rotate the crops around, yeah.
You keep the beds in the same spots?
Well, we'll see with this new one.
Yeah. Okay.
The old garden I had, I would move things around because it was a smaller garden. This is a much bigger garden, so we're just going to stick with what we have.
Okay. Then the last mulch question is, do these petroleum products, such as black plastic, et cetera, harm the soil and plants?
They don't necessarily harm them in and of themselves, but they do break down over time, and so you can get these little pieces of plastic kind of in the soil. As far as I know, they don't harm the soil, but it can't be a good thing to have plastic just kind of hanging around. So that's kind of the downside of using plastics, is that they do eventually break down. But as far as off-gassing or anything like that, I have never seen any research or anything that says that that's a problem.
I have one last question, and actually when you said the big tomato, it reminded me of my last question, was how do people grow those huge pumpkins for the fair?
They get obsessed. That's how they do it. They first start with the Atlantic Giant is this one pumpkin variety that has been bred to extreme to be world-class pumpkin.
Okay.
And so you first have to get the proper strain of Atlantic Giant. And there is a whole subculture of heavyweight vegetable growers out there mm-hmm. that will kill and die for like the right strain, and they'll barter their firstborn child for it kind of thing. So you first have to start off with the right genetics, the right pumpkin that's going to
create
the
big one.
And that
is a pumpkin. It's not just another squash
big. You know, all pumpkins are squashes, so it's technically in that same thing, but it's called a pumpkin.
It is called a pumpkin.
So first you got to get that, then you have to start it indoors, weeks, a couple months before you're going to actually plant it outdoors. Get it under lights, growing healthy, growing strong, fertilizing it, patting it, talking to it, encouraging it. And then out in the garden, you have to have a real fertile soil that you're putting that plastic mulch on to heat it up. And so as soon as you can get it out there, and I would not be surprised if some pumpkin growers are probably already putting their pumpkins out, they'll put them out early so they can get some early growth going on them. But since it's cool and pumpkins like it warmer, they'll create these little tents made out of plastic over individual plants. So if you ever see a giant pumpkin grower's field, you'll see these little tents kind of out there. And that's to concentrate the heat in there, keep them warm at night especially, so that they keep growing. And then once it gets warm, like you get into June and it's really consistently warm, they're feeding them regularly, they're watering them regularly, they're mulching around them, they're patting them, they're encouraging them, they're giving them pep talks. And then they just select a couple pumpkins per each plant to actually form. So once those early pumpkins form and they look like they're going to be a big one, they look like good, they'll cut off all the other pumpkins on that plant. And so they can concentrate all that energy into growing a big pumpkin. And it gets big, and it gets larger, and it gets larger. Sometimes they'll actually put them on pallets so that when they get to August, September, when they're 500 pounds, 700 pounds, 1,000 pounds, they can easily come in with a tractor and lift them off the ground, because that's one of the problems they have with them. Another problem is that they explode, which is kind of a weird experience to see a pumpkin explode. But they grow too big, too fast, and they just like implode on themselves, and they just flatten out like a flat tire.
Oh, wow.
Which can break a farmer's heart, especially someone who's been working hard at this for months and months. So that's kind of the risk they take when they really pump them up with a lot of these fertilizers. But that's how they grow them.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. That's great. Are there any other questions from the audience?
Do you plant marigolds around the tomatoes to get rid of the bad pests? You spoke about good pests. What about bad pests?
Bad pests. Bad guys. I'm not a big believer in companion planting, which is kind of what that is. You know, I haven't sat down and scientifically said, all right, I planted my garlic next to my tomatoes and they grew better and I had less pests. I really haven't seen that. I'm more of a believer in just having a lot of diversity in the garden. So planting a lot of annual flowers in with the vegetables, planting herbs in with the vegetables, even perennials, having little perennial beds here and there, kind of mixing it up so you can encourage a lot of different plants. The marigolds, I think it's the Mexican marigold, I'm trying to remember, that's the one that supposedly repels nematodes in the soil. We don't really have nematode problems this far north in the soil, so I'm not really thinking that there'd be a lot of benefits of planting just marigolds next to the tomatoes up around here. But I would encourage you to plant a whole diversity of flowers in the garden just to have that different plants there so the beneficials will be attracted to them.
So how do you get rid of the pests on the zucchini, the little beetles, and the rot on the tomatoes? Do you cut that off?
Depends on which one you got. So you got little pests on zucchini. So there's squash bugs, there's squash vine borers, there's cucumber beetles. So the first step is always identify what it is you have. And you can go online. I know Gardener Supply has a pest detective website or a subsite of their website where you can go in. They have all these photos of all these different pests. So once you figure out what you have, then you can figure out how to control them. So if you have cucumber beetles, for example, which are a big pest of cucumbers and melons and squashes, especially when they're young and small, you can control them with the yellow sticky traps. And these are yellow cards. You put a sticky stuff on them and just hang them with these. They have these little metal posts. You just hang them right above the plant. And the cucumber beetle likes the color yellow because they think it's a big cucumber flower. So it lands on there and then of course it gets stuck and then it dies. So that's one way to reduce the population of cucumber beetles. You can cover them with a floating row cover, but you have to watch underneath because a lot of times they'll sneak under and get them. Or you can use an organic spray. You can use diatomaceous earth would work on them, pyrethrum, spinosad is another new one that's out. So there's a number of ways to combat it, to keep it down. But it all starts with knowing what kind of pest you have, and then you kind of work from there.
There was one pest you talked about in the book that you just really kind of have to spray it off the plant.
The aphids,
That's the aphids.
Okay. Yeah, if you have aphids, like you get pea aphids and things like that, don't bother spraying them. Just get your hose with a nozzle and hold up that stalk wherever it is. You know, don't just leave it flying because you're going to blow it up. Hold it up and just spray it really heavily with water, and you'll blow off all the aphids right off that. And they usually are in the new growth because that's what they really like to feed on.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, great. Any others? Oh, there are a couple more.
What's your solution for Japanese beetles?
Beneficial nematodes. So Japanese beetles start as a little grub in the soil, a little C-shaped white grub that will feed on your lawn. So if you have dead patches in your lawn, chances are you probably have Japanese beetle grubs. But they usually are in your lawn areas close to the plants that they feed on. So if you have grapes or cherries or plums or hollyhocks or basil or all a number of things, roses, that Japanese beetles like, they're going to lay the eggs close to those plants, usually in a lawn or an area that's not disturbed. So in June, when those little C-shaped grubs kind of migrate up to the soil surface right before they pupate, that's a perfect time to spray beneficial nematodes on the lawn area. And beneficial nematodes are these little microscopic little organisms that go on a little search and destroy mission. They go into the soil using water pathways, they find the grubs, and they parasitize them and kill them. So at a couple houses ago, I used to have a bunch of roses there, and we had a big problem with Japanese beetles. And then I discovered the beneficial nematodes and sprayed them one summer. The next year I had maybe a third as far as the number of beetles. So you can spray them in June is a good time to do it. You can also spray them late August, early September, when the adults have laid their eggs and those eggs have hatched into little grubs in the soil. That's a second opportunity to do that. Unfortunately, you have to do it every year. It's not something that they can overwinter. But if you have a big problem with them, you can really reduce it pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Did you have another one?
I think you just answered the question, but I have the big white grubs.
Okay. Yeah, there's a number of different kinds of grubs. Yeah.
Same solution,
yeah. There's a number of grubs that are in there. There's Asiatic beetles, Oriental beetles. They all have, the beetles look different and the grubs look kind of similar. It's hard to kind of tell them apart, but you can use the beneficial nematodes for most of them. Yeah.
So the book is Northeast Fruit and Vegetable Gardening. Who's the publisher? I forget.
Cool Springs Press.
Really beautiful. So, Charlie, thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you both, and I feel like we have a whole encyclopedia.
I know.
That, again, was a conversation with Charlie Nardozzi. You can read more about his writing, coaching, and gardening advice at his website, charlienardozzi.com. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by my conversation with Charlie Nardozzi. You're digging in your garden, and you find something. What do you find? What's its history? What is it worth? What will happen to your life as a result of finding this item? Write a poem, a scene, a story, or a paragraph about it. Good luck with this prompt, and please listen next week for another. Write the Book has a Facebook page. If you're a Facebook user, please like us at Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. As always, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt or a guest to suggest, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. The Radiator is here thanks to community, support, and involvement. More information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM LP, Burlington, Vermont.